This is tape number four, side number one, of the interview with Bill Lucas, taking place on July 18th, 1994, at his home at 260 Prospect Street in Ishpeming. One of the things that I didn't ask about your early childhood was, what language was spoken in your home before you started school?
Well, Finnish was a natural language. Both father and mother spoke Finnish, and we did not start English until we started school. And then the mother and my father, they both picked it up from us. So eventually they got to be quite good at it, you know. And mother, she was always interested in reading. And she'd look over our books and she'd want to know what is that and how to pronounce it. And it was interesting, you know, sure. And when mother used to belong to the Kalivas, Lady Kalivas, they always look forward to Mrs. Lucas. You have to lead now the singing and the program for tonight. She was the master of ceremonies always at the meeting. And she tied into it. She handled it very nicely, you know. And during the WPA days, there was a program put out by the government. It would give some help for the older people to pick up English and history and read and write. And mother heard about that. She enrolled immediately. And the teacher used to come to West Ishpeming School once a week. And that was a lot of fun. she got to be pretty good. It was fun at home. All her friends then, there was about four or five of them. They were all neighbors, but they were male, and she was the only female. They'd always come, and they'd stop at our house, and then they'd go to tup, 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 sit down the path to the school. And you should have heard them discussing their assignment, what they were supposed to have for that day. And then they were laughing and giggling. Such fun, how to pronounce so-and-so word they already had forgotten how it was supposed to be in. But that was something, and mother was very disappointed when their sessions was then cut short in the spring. And she was looking forward to it. But she got along all right anyways. But she was good in Swedish also. Yeah, she could speak Swedish to quite an extent, because she learned that in Finland. And father, he could speak pretty good English, although he couldn't write it, but he could talk.
Did he learn English from you, from his children, mostly, too? How did he learn English?
How did I learn?
How did he learn?
He learned from communicating with, working with men at the mine. And that's how, the only way he picked it up. And at home, us kids talking, he picked up words, and he even had to, when he got, after he worked in the mines for many years, he had to give up a good job. And he was up in the Greenwood mine, he was offered a good job in Canada to take over and supervise a sinking of a shaft there, because he was an expert shaft man. And he didn't take it, because he said, I can't write English. I can talk, but I can't write it. And he had to make all those. Said, oh, we'll get better. Take it anyways. He said, we'll solve that, you know. But he wouldn't know. And he should have. Mm-hmm. Because there's lots of the modern day bosses that I had, they couldn't make their daily report. Their wife had to make the report at home for them. And they didn't know how their spelling. They couldn't spell. And, But it was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But just to listen to those old people, they already had their assignment in front of them. They were looking at each other and they want to know, how is it again that we're supposed to say it? and then when they tried to look, there they were going, like the mother duck going, and four siblings behind. But they enjoyed it.
Do you have any idea, when you were growing up, how many of the people, or what proportion of the people in the neighborhood spoke Finnish?
Oh, I would say a good 85%. Good 85% in this location. The Finnish, I guess they dominated the Finnish language around here. There was English, Swedish, and French. That's about it. But we all got along good. They did. They visited each other. And all the kids grew up together and played ball together and they fished. Went to school, intermarried, and all that. And it's typical American.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
So they had mother used to. We used to live right opposite your grandma's house in West Ishmi. Up in that two-story section.
That's on Marble Street.
Great-grandmother. She, Marion?
Grandmother.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she and my mother, they were very good friends, you know. They visited each other across the road, about the same age at that time, you know. Mm-hmm. And Marion could speak very good Finnish. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she could speak, yeah, because all her friends were Finnish, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And mother used to go over there and she'd pick up more and more English. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we lived there for maybe 1 year or so. Then my dad bought the old house next door here.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That's another question I wanted to ask you. You spent most of your childhood living in the house next door to where you are now.
Mm-hmm.
How many years of your life have you spent living either in this house or the house next door?
Since 1957. 57 and 40. That's 97. Oh, I spent over 40 years here. Longer than I have in the old one.
So it's 40 years in this house,
uh-huh.
And then how many years in the house next door?
I'd say maybe about 10 years, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You think maybe it's more than that? Because you told me that you moved from Marble Street to the house next door when you were how old? About maybe 4?
Yeah.
Okay.
It could have been more than that. Could have been more. I just figure it out. Maybe closer to 15, 20, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I want to ask two more questions about your mom. I've seen notices for the Kalevas. Can you tell me what the Kalevas are? What that club is for?
The Kaleva is a lodge. It's founded. That's a high lodge that's originated in Finland. And it's a social lodge. The friends meet and they read the Kaleva. That's the, what would I say? It's a read quite a bit in Finland. They've written poems on Kaleva. And it's still as strong in Nagani. And ladies of Kaleva, they call it. Yeah, he was an expert chaplainer.
Let me just stop a second. While we had tape stopped for a doorbell, we started to talk about Mr. Lucas's father. Tell me about your dad, and what did he tell you about his job sinking shaft? Tell me as much as you remember about him.
Well, he said one thing about you got to work hard, that's for sure. And you got to make sure everything that you do it in a safe way, so you will not be hurt. Of all the years that he put in sinking shaft, he never was, and never did get hurt. It's a miracle, you know. And he was, and it's, from what I heard the other guys talking, they said, by geez, there wasn't a job that he wasn't able to do. If it came to be a dangerous job, that they would kind of hesitate what they're going to do about it, he was going right away, and he solved the situation. One time they were sinking a shaft at Holmgren, and it was on afternoon shift, and Dad was a shaft miner, but he had a week vacation at the time, so he was out hunting. And we got a call from the mine. They wanted to know if Billy Lucas is home. They said, no, he's out deer hunting. Can you get a hold of him? We said, well, we haven't got a car here, but we can get somebody to drive out there. We said, tell him he's got to come to the mine immediately. They got a problem. So we hired a truck and we went out there, and Dad come home, and got lunch, and he went to work. That spoiled his deer hunting, sure. But it was a job that the others were afraid to tackle it. It was so dangerous, but he'd done it. And he appreciated it too. That was for CCI, you know, that job. So let's see, what are the others? And it was the following year, deer hunting season. Dad was out Flat Rock, and almost on the last day of the season, he shot a huge buck, and he had to leave it out in the woods. He figured, well, I'll take it in the morning and drag it. During the night, the storm got so bad that they had to pull out. He said there was snow up to their belt, and he had to come in. And when he come in, he told him at the mine, he said he had to leave his deer out the camp, couldn't get out. Well, the company offered a team of horses and a buggy, go out there and get it in. Sure, yeah, he said, take it even, we'll even put a driver on there anymore. Yeah.
Did he take them up on the offer?
No. He left it there. At the following spring, then, we went there, and the just knock the horns off the skull and hang them up, or hung them up on a camp door. And they stayed there for a year. And well, then from the horn mine, he went to the Greenwood mine. That's where he ended his, what he calls, work. He got sick and then he couldn't continue anymore. But up till then, he had the Lloyd and Barzenecker. So he knew what shaft work was. It was timber, big timbers, and he was an axe man. He knew how to use it, because he had to do lots of chipping and cutting, and he was a powerful man. He was a bigger man than I. I think he was about 6'3". Sure. There.
Okay. Let's go back and talk a little bit more. We had started talking at one point about how you met Corrine, and that you got married in 1946. But do you remember the day you got married and what your wedding was like?
Yeah, just December 3rd of 46. Yeah, we got married at the church. And it was snowing. Well, I think we almost had about 2 feet of wet snow. And miserable. We didn't go any place. We went out to camp. And we had just went through the big depression. You know, all that summer out of work. So we didn't have the money to go on the. On any long extensions, you know. Mm-hmm. Sure.
So that was the same year that there was that 100-and-some-day strike then,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you were working at the mine at that time then, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about when your kids were small and what Saturdays would be like. What would you do every Saturday, usually?
I mean, in younger days?
When the kids were smaller, yeah.
What, they were down on Saturdays?
Yeah.
Well, if it was summertime, we went out quite a bit on trips, you know. We went out picking berries, and we didn't go within 200 miles. And then be back always the same. Mm-hmm. And spend a lot of time at camp. Mm-hmm. And Presque Isle, Lake Michigami. Mm-hmm. And then out the farm.
Okay. Now, for anybody who listens to this tape and doesn't know which farm you're talking about, tell me whose farm it is and where it is.
That's at the old Grandma Corpy's farm, north of Ishmi. Okay. Yeah. It's still there, and I hope it stays there. Yeah.
Tell me what you remember about the Saturday night sauna ritual.
Sauna rituals?
Yeah.
Oh, that was quite a gathering. Everybody had stories to tell. And it was just a lot of fun listening to Grandma and Grandpa tell some stories, you know, from way back, because Grandpa had a history. He roamed around quite a bit in his younger days, you know, and he's been all over, and he related some stories of, you know, what he'd done. And where he worked, and the hazards, and the pay, and that was something, you know. And then his neighbor, Woody Franson, And his buddy was to come there for a sauna also, you know. And then they'd all chip in and when they were talking there. And Grandma was busy making coffee. Yeah. And,
let's talk a little bit about reading. You said your mother really liked to read and that's a hobby of yours. Tell me what you like to read.
What you like to read?
What you like to read.
Well, I like adventure, mystery, travel. Ever since I was in school, reading was my specialty. I loved to read, and I could memorize. I was always, when teacher gave us assignment, maybe 4 or 5 pages. I was always the first one to finish up in class. You know, give us so many minutes, and I was good for memorizing. I love to read. Maybe that's why lots of it's passed on, because we're all bookworms at home. Yes, and there's a continuous flow of books coming in from the library, and good books. Mm-hmm. And yes, I read in my grade school even. I read all Zane Grey's, all of Curwood's, and all name it, and Tarzan, and my hobby in school. That's funny thing, they do not teach geography hardly at all. It's neglected. And we had geography in West State Spring School. And I like to read ancient history and all that, you know. And I still do it, you know. And a lot of the books you read, and they all have ties in with ancient history and that, and all of Asia and China and incidents that happened thousands and thousands of years ago in there. That you don't. The only way you hear is from these authors, you know. And there's some really good books out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one good author is Mishner. I got one of his at camp now. I'm reading. It's about 1,000 pages. 1,052. Because I counted them last night. Yeah. And that should be good. Yeah.
Do you have any idea how many books you read in a month, or how many books that you've ever read?
Oh, I would say hundreds, as many hundreds than I've read.
Do you have any other hobbies that you like to do besides reading?
Well, there's lots of everyday hobbies that. Well, I like to go to camp, and I love to hunt and fish. Although I haven't been doing too much fishing, but I still like to hunt. And last year I didn't get to go hunting because my knee acted up. And the two previous to that, I had luck. 8-pointer in both years, you know. And I was getting the itch again this year. If my leg holds up, I'm going. Yeah. Got to get one more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Got to polish off a couple of old curls in the process,
yes.
Too.
No, I haven't had old curl for a long time. Yeah.
That's just a reference to the camp log at my father's hunting camp where Uncle Bill enters the daily deer sign record and the number of old crows that have died that day.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's move along to church. When you were growing up, Was church an important part of your life, and has it been, and is it?
It was every Sunday. Yes. I went to Sunday school, and I was confirmed, and I knew the catechism by heart, because I was good at memorizing, you know. So I had no problem. I doubt if I can remember it anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the Bible. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And my parents, they were strict. You had to go to Sunday school. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about when your own family, when your kids were growing up, did that habit continue when your kids were small?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember there being a lot of things that were organized around church activities or anything like that? Was that as important when your kids were growing up as it was when you were growing up?
Activities?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there's a lot of activities. And, for the older one, there is the, we start to take an interest in baseball, and then they had the horseshoe plane was coming in, and basketball and football. There was a period it was stagnant, and all of a sudden all the sports came, and it seemed like all the young kids went to ball games and, you know, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. Yeah.
Another thing I want to ask about is the neighborhood, this neighborhood that you live in. Can you, for anybody who had never been here, how would you describe what the neighborhood of West Ishpeming is like? How big is it? How many people live here? What kinds of people are your neighbors?
Well, person who's never been here before, I would say it wasn't so quiet as, you know, them days as it was, is now. But it was kind of a rough neighborhood here when we were. There was a lot of, you can say there was a lot of drinking going on, because there was no taverns, and the men, they more or less, they used to drink at home. And that kind of spoiled it, because for a lot of families there was a lot of fights going on. Mm-hmm. But then things started to change gradually, and you don't hear about that anymore, although there is some family dispute once in a while and domestic problems, but mm-hmm. it has changed quite a bit. Mm-hmm. It's quite peaceful. Mm-hmm. And they respect each other's property, and mm-hmm. and in the olden days, I know mother, every time when she washed the rugs outside and she hung the rugs to dry, she made sure they were dry before dark. She wouldn't dare leave them out there, somebody would swipe them off the line. Sure.
This is while you were growing up?
Yeah. Sure.
There was a lot of drinking going on during the time that you were growing up?
Yes.
Had it changed a lot by the time your own kids were growing up?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Prohibition. Then the taverns started coming, and then people started to drink downtown. And that's where they consume most of the drinking now. Yeah.
Somebody told me once that in this neighborhood there are really deep roots, meaning that there could be three or four generations of the same family living in the neighborhood. And I wondered if that's still true.
four generations, our own family?
That three or four generations would have grown up here. Is that true?
It's possible. It's possible. That's I know there's quite a few, but I couldn't say there's four, but I know there's at least two and three generations, you know, in one household, you know. And, it's quite nice neighborhood now. You don't want to talk anymore about the mine?
This is tape number four, side number two, of the interview with Bill Lucas, taking place at his home at 260 Prospect Street in Ishpeming. It is July 18th, and my name is Mary Tippett Andes. And while I was turning the tape over, we discovered there are some more mining stories, so I'm just going to let you go ahead and talk about those.
Yes, there was it was fun working at the Coal Shaft Mine on paydays. It was quite a scramble. There's some character there, they couldn't wait to get up from underground. Some didn't even pause to go into the shower. Soon as they took off their dirty clothes, on clothes, their clean clothes, and they just wiped their dirty face in a towel and put on a shirt, and off they go. And they had a run on the, all the way downtown to their favorite tavern. Sure. And it was something. Payday especially. There were so many of them. They couldn't wait to take a shower. And then one fellow even, he had, what do you call, he didn't go to the tavern, but he gave one of the guys a ride to town. He said, "You going to town?" Yeah, I said, "I'll take a ride." And he had a bundle of clothes he was going to take home to get washed, you know. And he forgot them in his friend's car. He left them in the back, you know. And his friend didn't notice that bag was towel and stuff was in the back. And until a couple of days later, he was wondering, what in the heck smells around here? He said it was unbearable. He looked and there was, this guy's dirty underwear and towel. It was just as brown as the iron ore. And he called, he threw it out of the car and left it outside his garage. And he said, "Well, if he wants them, you got to come here and get them." Sure, and his friend didn't know where he had left the clothes, you know. And sure, and he said that was up. He stunk up the car. You know, there's guys then too that would not change their clothes, their digging clothes. Some of them were so honest to God, they go many, many weeks, months. They stunk. And their towel that they used, you know, to wipe themselves off, well, they'd hang it on the door of their locker, you know. Well, anybody going by it, they could smell that. Well, at times it got so unbearable that they couldn't stand it. I know one guy, he took a towel and he threw it in a garbage can on the other end of the building. And boy, what is the guy that, you know, came up from underground and to look for his towel, he was going to shower. It wasn't there, it was gone. And he went like a maniac. He wanted to know who stole his towel. Nobody squealed. Nobody said a word. And then they told that, they reported that incident, and they said that he is, somebody better put him wise to it, that he's got to change his towel and clothes. Imagine how, to be told that to keep clean. Yeah. And he stunk. I used to change mine every 3 days. And, because when you're working, you're sweating, and all that dirty iron ore water, and sure, how they go, months. Yeah. And that was all. But them guys that they would race on a payday, they hurried to get down to the bar. They figured that the well might go dry.
Any idea? Was it like half of the guys, or a fourth of the guys, or three-fourths of the guys that would head for the bus?
Even, not even a fourth of the guys. They might have had about maybe a dozen or so guys that favored the bars. They had a, they could not resist a temptation. Stop in there, cast their check, a shot in the beer, and then that started. They didn't get home till 9, 10 o'clock at night. So,
and probably didn't have much paycheck left by then either, huh?
No. And there was even one guy, he worked at the mine, and he used to tell his wife that I gotta buy so-and-so, you know, articles, you know, for the mine, that I gotta get a new hose, and I gotta get some kind of a gadget for his machine, and that, and he said that that'll run about maybe $11, you know. And his wife, she fell for it, you know, and because he kept them that, he, when he cashed his check at the tavern, he kept $11, $12 for himself. He never did that for sure. And she had been telling some of her friends, she said, I don't understand how John, he can't never make enough money. He's always paying for something, you know, at the mine. All day, they were surprised. They said, he's kidding along. He gets that free. Sure. And they said that. Imagine she telling his wife that he got to pay for all that, you know. They eat their snipes.
Did you ever find out what happened when she told him that she had found out?
I don't know. I never heard. But he drank quite a bit, and he got run over by a car up on up the highway up here, and he was mean. He was an alcoholic, you know. But he got away with it for a long time. He was paying for all that expensive mine equipment, and he it is all free. Yeah.
I want to ask you a couple more questions about you and your life outside of mining. Do you participate in any other clubs or organized activities now?
Well, I belong to the Kiwanis. I've been with them about 15 years. And right now we had about 29 members. These are all members that are retired. Our youngest one is around 78. All feeble omen. Yeah. But we worked together a lot with the Kiwanis Noon Club. Mm-hmm. And they, what do you call it, interchange. And we've got a lot of help from the Noon Club on a lot of different things, you know. And it's a lot of fun. But I haven't been there for a couple of months now, so I know they called me up last week and they wanted to know if I was coming. Mm-hmm. But I just couldn't make it that day, you know. It just so happens always on every Thursday I got something to do. Yeah, so.
Would you describe yourself as a do-it-yourselfer?
Well, pretty close. Yeah. If I just want to do it, I can do it. And it might take time. And I'm not afraid to tackle it.
What kinds of things do you like to do?
Well, I like construction. Sure. And working with lumber and stuff like that. Yeah, tools.
We haven't talked a lot about Auntie Corrine. Did she work while the kids were growing up?
No. Mm-hmm.
Doing what?
She's a practical nurse at the ICU at Mail. Yeah. Yeah, she hasn't been retired too many years. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Now that you're retired, what kinds of things do the two of you like to do?
Does she like to do?
What do you, the two of you together, like to do?
Well, we've been busy out there in the garden, flowers and stuff like that. And monkeying around the house. And,
you still have your camp too, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I guess one thing I want to talk a little bit about is you basically have two homes, your home and your camp,
yeah,
that you maintain. And a lot of miners do have a home and a camp. How do you think it was possible on a miner's income for you to achieve so much, where some other people who maybe made more money would not have ended up with with two places like that? What do you think accounts for that?
That camp was originally started by my dad. This was 30 from 94. It's 64, right? 64, about 70 years ago, my dad bought this lot from the Whipple boys, and he started it, and just on a small scale. Money was scarce, and he salvaged a lot of lumber from around the different mines and that, you know, for sill work and floor joists. As you can go down the basement of the camp there now, all the 2x6s and all, they're all iron ore covered, and fir timbers, and so it's most of it in salvaged material. And then he kept adding a little at a time. When he could spare a few dollars, he put that on the camp. And finally got able to have one bedroom in there, and then we added on addition on there afterwards, you know. And then we added on a little addition on the other side. Yeah. And I got hired a basement dug out, and they got running water. I put up a sauna, and I love my sauna. I have two saunas now this year, this weekend. And I heat the sauna up, put the fire on early, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. After supper, then when you go for sauna, you come out of there, you think you went through a ringer. Tired, brutal. Mm-hmm. I stretch out and I'd fall asleep. I'd wake up 4:30 in the morning. Yeah. Sure, that's when it really is good for you. As long as you don't get chilled off, you know. And there is not like having sauna, although they're having right now difficulties with the people that own camps up there mm-hmm. with Longyear Corporation. Mm-hmm. We're fortunate we have private property. Mm-hmm. We don't have Longyear. And I feel sorry for them people, you know, where they going to get that money? Sure. Plus, lots of them are elderly people, and although they have been paying $500 a year lease, but Longyear Corporation wants them to buy the lot, a 300-foot lot at, I don't know, was it $80 a foot or something like that? It's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Especially if you're up in years already, well, you've got to think twice before. Some lot of them said that they can't afford it, they'll have to sell. So there's going to be a lot of camps for sale. And there is a lot of beautiful camps there. There's camps that are, imagine there's camps there that's over $100,000. You just think. Mm-hmm. One even there is, it's almost like this year, like a Tsar's winter palace, glass, triple deck, imagine. And Bart, the glass all around. That's was $92,000 he put on that camp. And he's on leased land. But he's got the money, he'll buy that lot. Sure. And there's some that's higher than that too.
I want to just ask you one more question, I think, and then we'll be all finished. When you mentioned sauna, it occurred to me that while you were growing up in the neighborhood, did every house have a sauna outside?
When we were growing up?
Yeah.
Yes. Around here, there were saunas all over. We didn't have any, but up here, there was Corpies had a sauna. And Calliers had a sauna. Lonerman's had a sauna. Lightman's had a sauna. And who knows, all the way down. You could go anywhere. 5 cents. For a nickel, you had a sauna. And we'd go there. And some of them were big. A lot of room. And you'd go in there with a bunch of old bucks, and you, this little, tiny little kid, gonna get up there, sit between two big guys, they're really big. You look at them like that. And you sit up there, you couldn't move because they squeeze you in, and they would throw in water on a rock. See, swish, swish, it's getting hotter and hotter. They didn't mind, they could stand, but I know that pretty soon I couldn't hold it no more. I bailed out from there, crawled out. Too hot, you know. And they laughed. Or said, you got to get used to it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then they'd sit in the sauna with cedar boughs. They'd be batting nukes off on the back, you know. Well, you know, they don't go for cedar boughs anymore. That's a traditional winter, you know, with cedar boughs. In summer, it's birch limbs. You take branches about that long, a tie a nice bundle, and they swish that birch. That's a traditional Finnish sauna. And we sat for a long, long time, but now everybody's forgotten about that. They don't go for that swish. And a lot of people have electric saunas now. But it is not the same. It is not the same as a steam sauna. You can notice it right away because I've been in two of them, and as soon as you get in there, you can sense there isn't that odor that you have in the steam that's present. That's in this, the old type wood stove.
Just for the record, describe for me, for anybody who isn't familiar with a wood stove, steam sauna, what can you describe how a sauna should be set up, in your opinion?
How a sauna should be set up?
Yeah.
Well, you know, you got to have a wood sauna stove. And you set the sauna stove in the room where you're bathing. And make sure it isn't too close to the walls. Having them at least, well, mine is about 2 feet away from both walls, so that nothing will burn. Although they're cement blocks, they won't burn. But you partition the sauna off, and where you're gonna bathe, there'll be a door going in from the other way, I have running water into the sauna, and anytime I want water, I have a barrel there, and if I want water, I just open the tap and fill the barrel up. And from there, then I fill the hot water tank that's in the sauna box. That's in partition, you know. That's the
fire. That's part of the stove. Okay.
And the hot water unit is here. And then I have a drain on the floor, and all that runs into a septic tank, you know. So there's no water laying on the floor. And then I have a ceiling in there to keep the heat from going up too high. And two benches there, one lower one and one top one. And there was Eric, our grandson, when he was growing up, he used to bring all his friends, you know, at the school. Sometimes there'd be about a dozen those kids in the sauna. Now there was laughter, joy, all on that bench. There's like a little bunch of little heads there. Then when they get through, take the stairway and jump in the lake and swimming. Mark up in the sauna, I get you. And they used to do that. They'd be there all night sometimes. Sure. And that sauna's made a lot of use. And right now, even Eric said that he can't wait to get out the camp and have a sauna. He says he hasn't had any since. It's almost 2 years now. They've been gone, so. They said in the sauna in Finland, even around here, all of the years back, there's a lot of children. They were born in the sauna. That was what you call, they didn't have the hospitals. They were way out in the wilderness someplace. Heat the sauna up, and they were delivered, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that I should have asked you about that I didn't ask you about that you'd like to talk about regarding mining or anything else?
Not that I can think of. Sometimes when you try and think, it doesn't come. Mm-hmm. It's just, and then all of a sudden, someday it'll pop up. But at the moment, I can't think of anything right now.
Good, then I think we're all finished. Thank you. Well, of course, after we finished turning the tape off, there's always one more interesting little tidbit that comes up. Let me ask you to describe the water pipes that you saw in the Selwood mine.
Yes, while we were walking through an old slope, we saw this, it looked like a 2x4 up there, strung alongside of the wall. And you know, what the heck is that? On closer examination, we noticed it was hollow. And it had been made out of 3-inch stock formed and into a like long tube. And that stretched out for about 60, 70 feet all along the drift. And it went up into the shaft and up the surface. We said, these, you didn't see any pipe around there. So they must have used it to get water for their drilling machines just from them wooden troughs of pipe. Imagine they made them airtight, watertight too, you know. And they could cut in on that same, just like they do on metal pipes, would get water in any other direction. Because when we got through at the end of the shift, and when we got through with our work, our exploration rather that morning, we told our boss about that, and he was an old, what do you call, miner, but he was a shift boss also. We asked old Jack, he says, to think that they have what do you call a wooden pipe in there? He said, yeah. He said, hey, that was a thing. And he said, while metal pipes was unknown. And even it's just the conditions and the tools that they had at that time. They made that Selwood was quite big. There was big stopes there all day. There wasn't more men killed there than because all they had to go by when they were working on there was candlelight. Imagine a candle stuck on your cap and that isn't very good light. And the work under that, and then you didn't know, you couldn't see it up higher what the dangers were up there and when the roof would be coming down or where you're going to step. Or no wonder said the accident rate was high at that mine. And but they took out a lot of ore, right? Even so. And then I don't know what reason they had for abandoning the mine. And they run out their lease or what, but they closed the mine. And then it was CCI. They had that as a escape route, a safety exit for the mine in case of any disaster or anything. It was never used though.
Would you have any guess on the dimensions of any of the stopes that you saw at the Selwood mine?
The depths of them?
Yeah.
Yeah, how high, how wide?
Oh, some of them were a good, some of them are about a good 20 feet. Good 20 feet. Mm-hmm. And long. Some of them went from your 100 feet. Then they branched off into different areas, you know, sites and that. And then they mined at different elevations. I don't know how far the cell would mine, how many levels they had there. But we were on the sixth level at Matabi. And if Selwood was more than six levels, I don't know. I never did find out.
And you were in the Selwood how many times?
In Selwood, I went twice there. That's where the stalagmites were. Well, that was something. When you go through this one door, and it's just like coming in from that door there. And that room was about this big.